Hi, this is Ken McCarthy with Jazz on the Tube, our podcast series. And today we've got a really interesting guest. She's contacted me a couple of times, and I looked into her background and really interesting history, and I thought it would be of interest to all of our listeners. I call this interview A Life in Jazz, and we're going to talk about all kinds of things, the jazz scene in San Francisco, jazz education, the process of becoming a recording artist, her experiences with some of the greats of the jazz world, and who knows what all else we'll get into, but I'm very excited about this call. Welcome, Dr. Margie Baker.
Hello.
Margie, you live out in San Francisco, and maybe we'd start, well, first let me let everybody know that Dr. Baker is an educator, and she's a performer, and she's a recording artist. So just file that part away. We're going to talk about that in more detail. But I want to talk about an aspect of jazz history that a lot of people may not be aware of. I was lucky enough to at least be aware of it, though I didn't get to experience it because I'm a little too young and I wasn't out there at the right time. But San Francisco, your hometown, and the Fillmore in particular, was one of the great jazz centers of post-World War II America. Can you tell us a little bit about your experience with it, growing up there, and the kinds of things you saw and the kinds of things you got to take part in?
Well, I grew up right in the center of the Fillmore district. We call it the Western Addition. And my mom brought me out there when I was a youngster. She worked in the shipyards as a riveter. So I grew up there in the late 40s, and I used to skate up and down Fillmore Street. And Fillmore Street at that time had many little small jazz clubs, and also all around the Fillmore area. And I couldn't go in them, but I would stop and look at the marquees, and I think up at the California Club, there was Billie Holiday, and then at the at another club, there might be Nat King Cole.
Jimbo's, I know, was a famous club.
And Jimbo, who was a dear friend of my mother's at Bop City, he would have many different superstars come in after hours. That was an after-hour spot.
I actually have a list that I assembled of some of the clubs. And you might recognize some of these names. Jax.
Tavern.
Yeah, a place called Elsie's Breakfast Club. Was that a jazz venue?
I don't remember Elsie's.
Oh. Jackson's Nook.
Yeah, I remember that. You know, I was just about 8 or 9, 10 years old at that time. So I don't actually remember a lot of them.
But oh, sure.
Jackson's Nook is one, yes.
And then the Plantation Club, Club
Plantation.
Alabama. New Orleans Swing House. There was a hotel there called the Booker T. Washington Hotel. Shelton's Blue Mirror.
Yes. Wally's
Soulville. And last but not least, Jimbo's Bop City.
And yes. Bop City was an after-hours spot. I mean, it wasn't open until, I think, 12 midnight, because the stars would play at clubs called the Black Hawk and Jazz Workshop and places like that. And after hours, they would come to the Fillmore Street, Bimbo's, Bop City, and they would jam all night.
My understanding of the history is that it was a pretty popular place, and Joe Louis visited, Marilyn Monroe was at Jimbo's, Sammy Davis Jr., Kim Novak, Willie Brown, who was mayor for a while, and
who
even
did you
young
say?
Willie Brown.
I grew up with him. We were both from East Texas. I went to college with him. When you said Willie Brown, I said, oh, is he putting Willie in the category of him, Kim Novak?
Well, believe me, in Willie's mind, I'm sure he is in that category, you know. But also, a young Clint Eastwood, who also was a Bay Area guy, he used to try to sneak in. Sometimes he was successful, sometimes he wasn't because he was underage. So just from this list of clubs and people that would go to Jimbo's and the other clubs, I think our listeners are getting a sense that Fillmore Street and the Western Addition was really an important part of jazz history. Now let's fast forward to the present. After what I guess everybody maybe not know the history, but I'll just give you my understanding of the history is the city decided that they had to, quote, redevelop, and I put that in quotes, the neighborhood, and basically tore a lot of things down and really changed very aggressively the nature of that neighborhood. And so the clubs were gone, and I mean, I remember even when I lived there, there were still vacant lots south of Geary that had never been rebuilt. But bit by bit, the memory of that area and that history, that very important history, started to come back, and people started to take steps to celebrate the history and bring the spirit of jazz back to the Western Addition, which I think is happening beautifully. So tell us a little about your involvement in that. Wasn't that your first experience recording?
No, it was not.
Oh,
actually,
okay.
Everything you said up to that point is pretty accurate.
Okay.
And, you know, yeah, the city redeveloped, and unfortunately, many African Americans had to move away.
Yeah.
And the clubs were closed, et cetera, et cetera. But then when Willie became mayor, he decided that he was going to try to help redevelop this into a jazz, the Fillmore into a jazz preservation district. And that's what he did. And when the Jazz Preservation District returned, there was a new nightclub called Rossellas there, right on Fillmore and Geary Street.
Okay.
And that's where I did my very first recording about the history of the Jazz Preservation District.
Gotcha. So that was great. So that was your first experience as a recording artist?
Yes, it was.
Wow. Now, so I hope when people go to San Francisco and they're walking up and down Fillmore Street at the eating sushi and buying whatever, just tune your psychic ear. You know, there was a lot of great music and a lot of great artistry that took place in that neighborhood, and it's definitely coming back. I went to a club. Unfortunately, I don't get to go out to California much, but I did go to something on Fillmore south of Geary. It was John Handy, an amazing show. That's another San Francisco native son, fantastic musician.
Yes.
And I'm trying to remember is it Rossellas now, or did it change its name?
It might have been Rossellas, or it might have been Yoshi's.
Ah, you know what? It was Yoshi's.
Yes. Yoshi's is a brand new venue in the Fillmore District. It was originally in Oakland, and it still is. But Yoshi, the owner, opened another one in the Fillmore District, and now, I mean, it's been sold, and now it's called the Addition.
Oh, okay.
That was a very famous jazz room before she sold it.
It was, yeah, just great, great music I heard there. And
John Handy and I went to college together, too, so he's a dear friend.
Oh, wow, okay. All right, so you got a little bit of a sense, and the history is very deep there, and I encourage everybody who's interested in jazz history, make sure you pay attention to that whole post-war period in San Francisco. And you said you're from East Texas?
Yeah, I was born in the sticks, the piney woods of East Texas, yes, in the sticks.
And that's the story of a lot of African Americans in San Francisco during World War II. A lot of work opportunities, and a lot of people moved specifically to work in the shipyards, and that's how the Western Addition got built up to be such a big commercial center with the hotels and the clubs and the restaurants. That's my understanding of how it happened.
Well, that's true. You know, Willie and I were both born in the sticks of East Texas.
Okay.
Willie Brown.
And you mentioned that he was very active and on the forefront in helping that legacy of the Fillmore and all the clubs.
That's right.
When he became mayor. Absolutely. And let's talk about your career. Now, you started as an educator, is that right? A music educator?
Yes. I worked 51 years for the San Francisco Unified School District.
Ah, okay. And you got your Dr. Baker, so did you get your doctorate in music?
No, I don't even know how to read music.
Really? No. Wait a minute.
I don't know now. Hello?
I'm still here.
I'm a vocalist. We vocalists don't even have to know music.
Wait a minute. Are you pulling my leg?
No, honestly, honey. I taught science and math, but I went into school administration.
Oh, okay.
Uh-huh, but I never taught music. I went as an elementary teacher way back. I taught little elementary music, to kids, kindergarten through sixth grade. But no, I was never a musician. That's why I said, I don't think you've read enough about me, because if you read a lot about me. You'll see, especially the Chronicle, you'll see that they had to push me into singing. I didn't think I could sing.
Well, this is what I want to talk about, is that your career as a vocalist started later in life than most people get started in their teens or their 20s.
Right.
But you're started later, and I'm really interested in how that happened, because there's a lot of us that maybe dream of maybe having a second career in music, and you're somebody that did it. Now, it sounds like initially it was against your will.
Well, if you read anything about me on the Internet, you will see. I mean, especially if you go to the San Francisco Chronicle articles and the Union articles. See, I was an educator. That's what I... Besides being a Christian wife, mother, school teacher, and all that stuff, I wanted to. My profession was kids, and that's what I did until I. But I had met Mr. Dizzy Gillespie as a young woman, and he and the musicians thought I had a voice.
Okay.
And I used to fight them. Maybe I do, but I don't care. Anyway, I also had a sister-in-law who's a jazz singer. Her name is Mary Stallings. She started out with Count Basie, and she worked with Dizzy and Billy Eckstein and all these folks. I was her chaperone. That's how I got into music. I used to chaperone. I used to have to travel with her around the world.
Okay.
She was 16, and I was 21.
Okay. Okay, so that got you into the scene.
That got me into the scene, and I was on the scene with her until she turned 21, and then I said, forget this. And then I went on back to what I was doing, but in the meantime, all my musicians, you know, Mr. Moody, Mr. Gillespie, were saying, you got a voice. I didn't know you could sing. I didn't know you were blues people. I didn't know you were this. I said, what are they talking about? So
now, how did they even hear you? Did you just sort of sing to yourself, or how did they even know?
No, actually, as I was traveling around the music scene with Mary, we would go to sometimes little private parties, and we'd all be singing and stuff like that.
Okay.
I can remember going to a party in Marin County with Mr. Gillespie and John Hendricks. And, you know, we'd sit around the piano. You know, people hear you doing those kinds of things. So
sure,
that's how they heard me, and I wasn't interested in singing.
Because you had your mind on other things.
I had my mind on my career. I was a school administrator.
Gotcha.
That was political. And anyway, that's how I really got into it. One night, I had gone to a Board of Education meeting, in I think it was the 1970s or something, and I was so depressed, I said, I'm going to just go out after this meeting and do something for myself. Well, I always did like music. So I went to the Hilton Hotel because a friend of mine was playing there.
Okay.
And this friend, who was a musician, had heard me sing, and when I was eating my dinner, he called me up. I was very disturbed. To sing a song. He used the power of the mic on me. And I went up, and I mean, I'm not rude. I mean, I said, what is he talking about? So I went up, and I sang a song. I left my heart in San Francisco. Well, that night, Conrad Hilton and his son, Baron, and all of his top executives were sitting in that audience.
Uh-huh.
And when I gave my George, who was his name, George Hennepin, when I gave him a dirty look and went back to my seat to finish my meal, here comes these beautiful top executives, about two or three, Dr. Baker, George, told us your name. Mr. Hilton was very impressed with you, and he'd like for you to work for him. I was shocked. Ken, I said, wait a minute, sir. I went through this spill. I am a Christian, a wife, a mother, and a school teacher, but I am not a singer. He says, well, you have both of them. You have a beautiful voice, and Mr. Hilton was very impressed. And you know, Mr. Hilton is 98 years old, and he's heard a lot of people. So that's how I got into it. I said, well, no, sir, I'm not a singer. I'm sorry. I'm an educator. And they said, yes, George, the musicians were telling us that. And what we would do, Mr. Hilton, would hire you around your convenience,
huh.
Your convenience. And I said, okay. Oh, my goodness. So they said, go home and talk to your husband about it and give us a call next week to see what you decide. Well, that's how I got into singing, because I went home and I spoke with my husband. My husband says, what? He says, well, if you want to be a fool and burn the candles at both ends, go right ahead. Because, you know, I was a school administrator at the time. But Mr. Hilton gave me two nights a week during the regular school year, and five nights a week in the summer when I didn't have to work.
Okay.
So they were very nice to me, and I stayed at the Hilton for 23 years.
Wow. And then that night that started it all, you had just been at a school board meeting. It was just another day in the life. You didn't anticipate anything. You didn't expect anything. You didn't plan anything. And next thing you know, you have a 23-year gig at the Hilton Hotel in San Francisco.
And balked at it in the beginning. I thought they were nuts.
I love this story.
I said, "Mom, me? I mean, I was trained to be a school teacher, not a singer."
Oh my goodness!
So that's how it happened, Ken. And from there, things just blossomed. The Lord was so good. Then, you know, Mr. Gillespie, who had known me, and my sister-in-law and me earlier. I mean, he introduced me to Mr. Jimmy Lyons, and Mr. Lyons had me working for the Monterey Jazz Festival, traveling all over the world with them for 7 years. So things just blossomed.
Wow.
And I never wanted to record. That was something I said, oh, my God, because I can't stand my voice. I can't. But here I am.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your experiences with Dizzy Gillespie, you know, one of the great, great masters of American music. You know, I think no matter how much we talk about him, it's so hard to wrap our, in my feeling, it's so hard to wrap our minds around the extent of his genius. You know, when you listen, for example, to his playing with Charlie Parker, just unbelievable. And then you realize he had such a huge role in bringing Afro-Cuban, Afro-Latin rhythms into American music. And then all the things he did throughout his whole career, I mean, he's just a giant among giants. And you actually knew him, and he was part of your career. And what, can you share a story or two about any experiences you had with him that might, you know, illuminate, you know, his life for us?
Well, you know, there was a nightclub here that you knew, Black Hawk. Have you heard of the Black Hawk?
It's famous. Anybody that's got a good record collection has to have a few Live at the Black Hawk records in it.
Well, the Black Hawk was the most famous jazz club at that time. In San Francisco, it no longer exists, but that's where, you know, my little friend Johnny Mathis got his start. I grew up with him too.
Oh, really? Wow.
Oh yeah, Johnny. Yeah, he and I went to college together.
What? Wow.
But anyway, the Black Hawk. My sister-in-law Mary was 17 years old, and she went at that time that when Mr. Gillespie came here at the Black Hawk. And she was 17 years old and wanted to meet him. She had never seen him. So, you know, she couldn't go by herself. So I went with her.
Okay.
And I was 21. And that's where we really met Mr. Gillespie.
Okay.
He was so impressed with us two. I don't know, because Mr. Gillespie was, I think he had an eye for the ladies anyway. And he was impressed that we were both so young.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And that's how I met him. Well, he hired Mary and took Mary on a few gigs, and that's how I really got to know him. And he just, I don't like saying this, but he was very respectful of me. He was very impressed of the fact that I was, you know, an educator and not interested in music and all that. He was very impressed with that.
Mm-hmm.
And we became great, great friends. As a matter of fact, Ken, I have pictures of him and us and groups. I have pictures of him when he became very, very sick. And I don't I don't show those pictures to anybody because every time I look at them, I want to cry. He had lost so much weight, and he didn't, you know, naturally. He was a shell of the Dizzy Gillespie that we all know.
Mm-hmm. So
but
this
that's
was,
how I met him, and he just became so friendly with me and all of his band. His side men call me even today. I get calls from many of his side men, like Michael Longo.
Oh.
And Chris White.
Wow.
You know, he had so many. But anyway, I met him, and I never worked with him for money.
Mm-hmm.
But wherever I appeared, if he were there, I would go and see him, and he'd always have me on the stage singing, whether it was in Tokyo, Japan at the Blue Note or, you know, in Los Angeles or wherever, at the Parisian Room. Wherever I went to see him, he was going to bring that mic out to me. Can you imagine that? To sing a song.
Oh, wow. You know, it's funny. That reminds me, we were talking earlier about I went to see John Handy, and he did something similar. He's playing a set, and it was great. And then at one point he said, hey, I have somebody very special I'd like to bring out. It was a young lady, a singer, and he gave her a chance, you know, to sing from in front of the audience. She was excellent. And it was a nice addition to the evening for everybody and helped give this young lady some exposure and experience in front of the audience. That's great. And then he was instrumental in you connecting with the Monterey Jazz Festival. Can you talk a little bit about that? That's quite an interesting story.
Yes. Well, see, he and Mr. Jimmy Lyons had been friends for years. I think Dizzy appeared there practically every year, you know. I brought Dizzy to the San Francisco Public Schools in 1976 because it was the bicentennial, and I wanted our kids to know where our native art form, jazz, what it was and you know, who developed it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, I couldn't bring any of the traditional jazz people because I think the only one at that time that was still alive was Louis, I'm not sure. But I did bring Mr. Gillespie to our schools, and he stayed with us for 1 week playing at so many of the schools and, you know, teaching them about bebop and all that stuff.
What an amazing coup for your kids.
To hear
the story of bebop straight from Dizzy Gillespie.
Yeah.
And, of course, in my recollection in those years, I was just a teenager, but I remember that jazz was kind of the art form always has energy, you know, no matter what's going on. But it was sort of struggling on the commercial side and on the popular side. You know, rock and roll had come and sort of taken dominance, and there was just less jazz consciousness in the 70s and the 80s, and things have really turned around now. But I think in those years, it just wasn't, you know, didn't have the same broad, you know, interest that it has, that it's growing back into today. So bringing Dizzy Gillespie to high school kids and letting them learn the history straight from him. Wow, what an amazing thing! And
well,
the reason I bring this story
high
up,
kids.
This is kind of embarrassing, but I should tell it because there's a lesson in it. One, I went to school in New York City, and one of the teachers was friends with Mary Lou Williams, the great piano player.
Yes.
You know, who taught, you know, Bud Powell and taught Thelonious Monk harmony. I mean, this is a really important person and a great player.
Yes,
and
she was.
So he, oh, my goodness. So he arranged to have her come and play. But, you know, I'm a teenager. I'm all into rock and roll. I didn't get it. And I tell you, every day that I think about it, I wish I could go back and change my attitude. Because what an amazing opportunity that would have been for somebody who had their ears open. But, you know, we get older and we get wiser.
Oh, listen, I could tell you some things that would probably make your hair stand up straight on your head. By the way, Dizzy came for all my schools, kindergarten through 12.
Oh, I love that. And I bet he was, I bet he, you know, with the charm he had and his love for people, I bet he connected beautifully with all the kids.
And the kids wrote him some of the cutest letters in all kinds of handwriting, but he was so impressed. But you see, another thing I want you to know, because I met Mr. Gillespie on a personal level, I never thought of him as being this this genius that you're talking about. I knew he was, but I didn't think about it. You know, for example, you're a genius in what you do, Ken. I just want to give you an example. You are a genius in what you're doing with Jazz on the Tubes. I'm sorry. That's genius. But if I get to know you as a friend, I don't think of that. You know, you're just my friend Ken.
Right, right.
And I have a journalist. His name is Mr. Kirk Silsby.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. He writes for Downbeat and all that.
Oh.
He's just Mr. Kirk Silsby. I don't think of him as being this terrific journalist, critic, writer.
Mm-hmm.
And with Dizzy, when I was around him, he was just Mr. Gillespie.
Because
he was older, you know, 15 years older. And that's
sure.
what he was. And
sure.
But he was, as you said, I mean, as you have, not in these words you have said it, but he was on his own planet. And
yeah.
so many people have said to me, Margie, nobody could touch him. I said, my goodness, you know?
Yeah. And you know, such a, you know, you can see it even for those of us that didn't know him as a person, you can just see the generosity of spirit just flowing out of him in all his public appearances and all his videos and all his recordings. I mean, he must
have been.
Isn't
that interesting? And I never looked at him in that way because I was never really deeply into music the way you are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I love music. I love just, you know, being a spectator.
Mm-hmm.
But I never
mm-hmm.
thought about participating, so I never really dug deep into it. I sing. I never really wanted to do anything with my singing, but my singing has taken me a little bit further than I ever would have gone myself. Because I'm not interested in stardom, but, I mean, I've had Michael Longo sign me up with his Consolidated Artist Productions. I've been all over the world in it. I met some of the most beautiful people, like James Moody. Now, that was a beautiful man. Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he was a wonderful artist, too.
What was he like as a person, for those of us that, you know, never had the opportunity to meet him?
Oh, he was just a beautiful person. Really. So, you know, these are the things that music has gotten me, has rewarded me with. But as for, oh, and listen, my CDs, Downbeat has been so nice to me.
tell us. So tell us about the recordings that are out there.
Well, I've made four. The Live at Rosalus is a historical journey through music in the Jazz Preservation District. And then I made one live at Bach Dancing Dynamite Society. Have you ever heard of that?
No, I never have. Is that a San Francisco thing?
That's in Half Moon Bay. That was one of the world-class concert halls in Half Moon Bay.
Really?
You
can you tell me the name? Can you tell me the name again? It's such an unusual name.
It's called Bach Dancing and Dynamite Society.
Bach Dancing and Dynamite Society. Amazing.
And it was founded in the 50s by a gentleman named Mr. Pete Douglas. And Mr. Pete Douglas just passed away. And Downbeat has me in, I think, this issue. I was paying tribute to Mr. Pete Douglas.
Oh, okay.
Uh-huh.
So you have a recording live from there?
Uh-huh. It's called Live at Bach Dancing and Dynamite Society. And then I have another recording called A Bit of Jazz and More, because I was kind of really interested in smooth jazz.
Okay.
I mean, I love some of that stuff. You know, I love Grover Washington and, oh, Lord. So I did a CD with a bit of smooth jazz.
Okay.
And then my final one, I paid tribute to all the musicians that I've worked with here in the Bay Area. It's called So Many Stars.
Oh.
And Downbeat has just really been nice to me.
Great. And what label is that on?
All of my CDs are on CAP, Consolidated Artist Productions.
Is that a San Francisco?
No, that's owned by Michael Longo and Dave Usher and all those folks back in New York City.
Oh, okay.
I don't know whether you've ever heard of Michael Longo or not.
I know. I recognize his name.
Yeah, he was Dizzy's pianist for 23 years.
Wow.
And they, you know, after that, they started a record company and I'm one of the artists, yes.
Nice. So for people that are looking that up, it's Consolidated Artist Productions, CAPT.
CAPT, that's what it's called, CAPT.
So are you involved in doing any music education now, or is it just performing, or what
well,
are
I
you involved
in? Well, I've never done too much music education, except sometimes I was hired as a consultant in college classes to, you know, give a presentation.
Mm-hmm.
But you remember, I'm not a music educator.
No,
I'm a
science and math
educator.
No, I get it now. I get it now. And
bless your heart, and you might not even be interested in this interview because I'm not considered a Carmen McRae or Sarah Vaughan. They were beautiful musicians as well as singers.
Yeah,
you know
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
Well, and I don't know about this little new girl, the little girl with the French name. She, oh, wow. What's her name, Ken?
Uh-oh. I'm not forming a picture of it. I don't know which one you mean.
I think she won an award for, her name is Cecile McLaurin-Salvant.
Oh, really? That's new to me.
You don't know her?
I'm kind of, you know, I'm sort of paying more attention to the older stuff than what's going on today.
I'm so glad. Because I don't know any of the great new artists.
Okay.
I'm like you. I'm kind of paying attention to the older stuff. But this new gal, she won the Thelonious Monk Award or something.
Oh, really?
You've never heard of her? You're an expert.
I'm an expert on what? I'm not an expert on what's going on. I'm more of an expert on things that have happened. But that's good to know, though. I will definitely check her out.
Check her out. Cecile McLaurin Salvant, S-A-L-V-A-N-T.
Great. Thank you for that tip.
Should be interviewing you because you're the most interesting of this jazz stuff. You're much more interesting than I am. I'm just an old fuddy-duddy who just enjoys, you know, what I've done for many years.
Hey, can I ask a question about your music? Even though you didn't have a music education formally, let's say, surely you grew up in a musical environment. What kind of music were you hearing growing up, and do you think it had an influence on how you developed as a singer later in life?
Well, let's put it this way. I'm an African-American, an old African-American singer that never sung in a black choir. But both of my grandpas were ministers. One was a Baptist minister and one was a Methodist minister. So I spent lots of my time in the church. And I know that gospel music I know it's in me through osmosis.
mm-hmm.
And but then as a little child back in East Texas, I remember the old rhythm and blues, the real rhythm and blues, not what these folks are calling R&B. And now that's rhythm and blues back there to me was Louis Jordan, Charles Brown. You know, I remember the old rhythm and blues stuff. Andy Kirk, Jimmy Lunsford. Oh, my. These were the people that influenced me. And Buddy Johnson and his sister Ella.
Mm-hmm.
I was listening to them when I was a little girl. And I was singing Ella's songs when I was a little girl. And let's see. And then in high school, I became very interested in Dinah Washington. And she was, I just loved her. And I loved Sarah and Ella, of course.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know too much about Carmen McRae at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But I used to listen to music. And then in the 50s when I was in high school, we danced to music, you know. And the one song that we really loved to dance on was Manteca.
Really?
And I didn't know Dizzy Gillespie from anybody, but I did like Manteca.
Wow. That was such a landmark piece of music, you know, for the whole history of American music.
Yes. And this was, I guess, the first time that I graduated from high school at 15. So this was probably the first time that a 14 or 15-year-old had heard this swing music mixed with Afro-Cuban.
Oh, I just, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, that was a major major breakthrough. And then and interestingly enough, that was, as you know, that was Dizzy Gillespie's doing.
Well, I know now, but I didn't know when I was 14. I was just doing the Texas Hop. I didn't know Dizzy Gillespie from Charlie Parker. I wasn't interested.
Right. But then it's amazing, though, later in life,
yeah,
you meet the guy that made it happen.
Yes, because back then I was more interested in Roy Milton and the Solid Cinders and you know, the L.A. musicians and that rhythm and blues stuff that you probably don't know too much about because you're so heavy into bebop.
Well, I've spent a fair amount of time in New Orleans, and if you spend any time at all there, you realize, you know, that was a major center for the old great rhythm and blues music, and you definitely can't help but come across some of it. So I have a bit of a feeling for it.
Yeah, but you love your bebop, don't you?
I do. I think it was one of the great flowerings of creativity, and then the things that came after, and it was just a real, real door opener for so many people.
You're so smart. I see, I told Mr. Gillespie, I didn't understand bebop. I'm sorry. I really got into it later on when the bebop became kind of progressive jazz, but I didn't understand bebop.
Well, everybody's got their thing that they like. It's kind of a hard medium for a singer to wrap their vocal cords around.
Well, I wasn't a singer. I wasn't a singer until I was 40.
Okay.
I heard Manteca, which was not typical bebop, when I was 15.
Okay.
Bebop was developing in 40s, right?
Yep.
And I didn't know. I used to hear this stuff, and I didn't know it. Of course, I didn't think like Cab Calloway and Louis Armstrong, because they thought it was Chinese music.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there was a lot of pushback.
Yes, it was. But I was just a little kid, and I just didn't understand it. But I grew to understand it, you know.
Tell us a little bit about what you're doing these days. Are you performing? Do you have any recording plans?
Well, I just finished a recording. My record release party was held in June.
Oh.
So, yes, I will be doing one more. I want to try to do two more. I want to do one gospel recording if I can, but you know, I'm 80 years old.
You are?
Yes.
I didn't realize.
You didn't know that?
I should have done my math, but no, I didn't. It didn't occur to me.
Well, I've been at the Hyatt for 12 years, the Hyatt Regency Hotel.
Okay.
I'm an artist in residence. I work there every week.
So people can go and hear you if they're in San Francisco. Is it in San Francisco, the San Francisco Hyatt?
It's the Hyatt Regency Hotel at the airport in Burlingame, which, you know, those are suburbs of San Francisco.
Not far at all. So
no.
So people can go hear you sing then.
They do all the time. Yes. Uh-huh. Oh yes. I've been there for a long time. I was at the Hilton for 23. I've been at the Hyatt for 12. So I can't get, and I was at the Ritz-Carlton for 7. I can't get out of the hotels. What's wrong with me?
Hey, it's a good steady gig, you know.
Yeah.
So what night do you sing at the Hyatt?
I sing there for the Sunday brunch.
Okay. That's cool. So for our listeners in the Bay Area or people that are flying in or out of San Francisco, if you're around on a Sunday for brunch, you should definitely go to the Hyatt.
Yeah, I'm there from 10 to 2 every Sunday.
And hear Dr. Baker.
Well,
is that how do people call you when you're performing? Do they say Dr. Baker?
I don't want them to call me Dr. Baker. So many people do because they've read all this stuff about me.
Uh-huh.
And they refer to me as Dr. Baker, and I have to say, wait a minute. 51 years with the San Francisco Public Schools, I was Dr. Baker. But I am not Dr. Baker in the music world. I'm plain old Margie. And I want you to know this. I am a big, black, African-American honky-tonk singer. That's what I am now. I'm not Dr. Baker. No.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying.
I do.
The titles
I do.
Don't mean that much to me, sweetie. I you know. I have one title that means a lot to me, and that's I am a child of God. That's the title that means the, that's the most important title I could ever have.
Mm-hmm.
All the other titles, who cares? I don't care if you're a doctor or a lawyer or an Indian chief.
I gotcha. But well, Marge Baker, you've had a really interesting life with a lot of unexpected twists and turns musically, and I just when I first heard your story, I was just tickled by it. You know, a lot of people, you know, have a very definite plan of how they're going to do a certain thing, and in your case, this was just something that just came thanks to the recognition, some good luck, I guess, and good ears on the part of the people that recognize your talent, and then the people that pointed you in the right direction, like Dizzy Gillespie pointing you to the festival, which you were involved with for years, Monterey. And the great thing is, I think the best thing of all, is that people can go hear you right now. We're doing this recording on a Saturday, but, you know, if I were in San Francisco, I would be heading to hear you sing tomorrow at the Hyatt.
Well, may I say something to you? I am very appreciative that you would take the time to interview me, and I do know how to speak the King's or the Queen's English, but with you, I just let my hair down and spoke in an awful lot of Ebonics.
All right.
And that's how you made me feel. And I don't know, I hope that doesn't affect the interview.
No, I think it'll be fine. I think it'll be fine. I'm really glad to get to share this story with people. I'm glad to meet you. Glad to meet you.
And you keep on keeping on now, and I'll keep on donating.
Well, thank you for that. That was very. It's really morale boosting. You know, pays bills too, but it's such a morale boost when somebody takes the time out to write us and send us something to help with our expenses. It's just like, wow, they like us.
Well, on my interview, would you let people know that you are a treasure? Jazz on the Tubes is a treasure. It is, I have never seen anything like it, so thorough and so much love is shown in your little notes that you write before we view the video, and you tell everybody, I said, they should donate something, even if it's $5.
Yeah, well, every little bit helps, and it is a morale boost. Like I said, you know, it's a validation. And it's good. It makes me think, oh, well, we have to do better. You know, now we have to do better because all these people are helping us, you know. So it's good inspiration for us.
Well, we're going to keep helping you.
Well, thank you, Margie. And again, everybody, the record label that you should be looking for is CAP, also known as Consolidated Artists Productions. And Sunday brunch at the Hyatt near the San Francisco airport, you should be making a trip there for a fun event. I know I will next time I'm out in San Francisco. Looking forward to meeting you in person.
God bless you.
And you too, Margie. Bye-bye.
Bye.